Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Versus History, the podcast. It's me, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, your host. And today we are joined, I think, for the fourth time on the Versus History podcast by historian Damian Lewis, who's here to discuss his brand new book. It only came out last month, so October 2022, I believe. Damian, welcome back. It's great to have you with us. How are you and what have you been up to since we last spoke?
Yeah, I'm good. It's great to be back. Always good to be on your show. I've been writing and not talking to my family. banning them from my study and making my daughter scared to come in and ask me to buy her textbooks for her school and stuff like that. So I'm a terrible father and maybe a passable author, but you know.
I was going to say you're a damn fine historian and you're churning out the books at a rate of knots and the podcast series versus history. So historical perspective, we are very, very grateful. Tell us what about your new book's all about and why did you choose to write this one in particular? Over to you.
Yeah, so why did I choose to write it? Great question. 10 years in the making. And just to try and, you know, in a nutshell, 10 years ago, I was approached by a mutual friend who said, Colonel Blair Mayne, who was the Paddy Mayne, as he was known, was the or is the most highly decorated British Army soldier from the Second World War. And during 5 years of behind enemy lines operations, he collected massive amounts of war memorabilia and documentation and photographs and film, etc. And all of that was carried back to his home in Mount Pleasant in Northern Ireland, the main family home, and stored in his war chests and in the cellars. And would you like to have a look through it? And that's pretty much a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity as a historian. And so I said, yes.
Of course you did.
Of course I jumped on a plane, flew over to and visited Mount Pleasant and the main family home. And you know, actually, to be frank with you, you know, there are times in one's life where you think, gosh, I don't quite feel worthy of this enormous honour, which is how I felt as I rifled through and studied that incredible treasure trove of history, you know, from North Africa and then all the way through Europe and even into Germany itself in the final months of the war. And from that emerged the picture of an extraordinary individual. So this book, SAS Brothers in Arms, is not a biography of Colonel Mayne, but he is the central character. And he becomes the central character essentially because, of course, the SAS was founded by David Stirling in North Africa. But after Stirling's capture in 1943, Mayne takes over really command of the SAS. And so it's telling that origin story from this absolute trove of wartime history.
Fantastic. Thanks for that, Damian. Okay, a question for you to root this in its historical context. I've got a little snippet, so I'm going to read a little bit of your work back at you. So it goes like this. In the summer of 1941, even as Britain suffered numerous defeats, a band of maverick warriors emerged from the North African desert intent on waging war as it had never been fought before. So the first half of the question is, just how badly was World War II going for Britain and her allies at that point in 41?
Well, I mean, we had suffered a string of defeats ever since, you know, the defeat in France, the Battle for France and Dunkirk. We'd almost had no land victories. Battle of Britain, of course, you know, a stunning victory for the RAF against all odds. We'd weathered the Blitz, so we'd done okay in the air war, you can argue, but on the ground, we had suffered pretty much defeat on all fronts.
Those are rear guard actions as well, aren't they? Both defensive actions, I guess.
They're both defensive actions. And of course, you know, like from June 1940, even as the little ships were carrying away the last of British and Allied troops from the Dunkirk beaches, Churchill famously averred that, you know, we needed to attack was the best form of defence and formed his butcher and bolt raiders and sent them out to ensure that no German could sleep soundly in their bed at night and to leave a trail of German corpses in their wake, to capture the Hun, kill or capture the Hun, and then away. Those were his words. So he had, you know, urged his special duty volunteers to do this. And there had been these pinprick operations since then, some of which were very successful, of course. But it was in the North African desert in 41 with the formation of the SAS that this really crystallized into a new and unheralded and unknown and unseen and unwitnessed form of warfare, particularly within the British Army, which you could argue was quite hidebound, and allied forces.
Okay, to build on that question then, so what dimensions and or capabilities did the SAS add to the British Armed Forces that were hitherto underserved? So what difference did they actually make during World War II and beyond? What like value added did they bring?
Okay, so the SAS were formed with the sole purpose of going very, very, very far behind enemy lines. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of kilometres, to strike at their air bases and their supply columns in these fast-moving hit-and-run attacks, in which surprise was the absolute raison d'etre. And bear in mind, they were not there to fight. They were not there to engage in combat operations. They were there to carry out daring sabotage missions, so blowing up scores of enemy warplanes or shooting up, you know, massed enemy convoys, and then melting away again just as quickly. That was their raison d'etre, and this had really never been done before. And it took a very particular kind of mindset. It took maverick, self-starting, imaginative, self-thinking individuals who could think outside of the box and come up with and imagine ways to strike at the enemy in this way, which the enemy could not conceive of themselves. And in terms of how successful were they, well, you know, you can judge it by General Rommel's, Erwin Rommel's famous words on the SAS towards the end of the North Africa campaign, where he said, "This unit," and I paraphrase, but it's words to the effect, "this unit caused me more damage than any other unit of a similar strength." When in fact, and he called them Stirling's commandos. That's how Rommel, you know, began to speak of them. And he actually formed a bespoke, specially trained elite unit in the German army, purely for the function of hunting down Stirling's commandos, as he called them, the SAS. They even took captured Willys Jeeps, these fantastic vehicles, four-wheel drive vehicles that the SAS mounted machine guns on, to carry out these fast hit-and-run attacks. He even took some of those captured Willys Jeeps and gave them to his German paratroopers that were training to track down the SAS, so they could work out how they operated, what their capabilities were, and how better to defeat them. And in terms of how successful they were in North Africa, just to start with, you know, the estimates are, and these are proven, because the RAF flew air reconnaissance missions over the air bases the SAS raided 48 hours after, to check and verify the number of warplanes destroyed. Well, 387 definite enemy warplanes destroyed, and very likely in excess of 400. It's a stupendous and phenomenal feat. You know, it's unrivaled by any other ground unit of anything like, you know, the same or greater strength. And bear in mind, at least 100 of those warplanes were down to one man, and that was Lieutenant Colonel Blair Mayne, and his incredible leadership and panache at these behind enemy lines raiding operations.
That is quite phenomenal. Thank you very much indeed, Damien. Okay, then tell us a little bit about, if you will, Colonel Paddy Mayne and the founder of the SAS, David Stirling II. How instrumental were they? Over to you.
So Stirling had the idea of founding the SAS. He dreamt up this idea of forming this bespoke, unique, some would say piratical band of raiders in the desert. And he had the idea largely because the North African desert was this unique environment. You can imagine it, thousands and thousands of kilometres of desert, nobody there, unpopulated. Everyone believes it's impossible to you know, traverse the desert. So to go and mount these behind enemy lines operations, Stirling believes otherwise. And he believes that's the opportunity. By using the desert, you can outflank the enemy and hit far, far, far behind enemy lines by surprise. if you can navigate your way through it and survive. This was Stirling's great idea, and Stirling was without doubt a visionary, and he was a great leader of men. He had this unrivaled ability to inspire people and to make them feel special and to make them go the extra mile and undertake these absolutely incredible, extraordinary missions. But what Stirling needed to make his SAS successful, to make his idea take wings, was a real warrior who could inspire the kind of combat spirit into his recruits. And that really was Colonel Maine. You know, Maine was somebody who was recruited by Stirling, and he came to unit with combat experience already. He'd been on the Litani River landings earlier that year, which was an intense and horrendously costly commando operation by Number 11 Commando. But out of all the squadron leaders in that operation, Maine pulled off the most successful of any of those operations. He came back to friendly lines eventually with something like 70 enemy captives in his number, so far more than he had under his command, and enormous amounts of captured weaponry. So what Maine bought was the kind of the combat experience and the martial spirit. And so Stirling had the flights of fancy, the great inspirational ideas. Maine took those ideas and made them a hard reality at the coalface of combat operations. And, you know, these two, David Lloyd Owen, who was one of the long-range desert group commanders, and the long-range desert group initially were ferrying the SAS to and from targets. The long-range desert group were a desert reconnaissance force. And David Stirling said of Maine and Stirling, he said they were the ideal combination because they were terrifying in their combined effect. And I think he was a great observer of these two individuals in action. And they had their falling out, Stirling and Maine, very early on, when the SAS really, right at the very start, lost one of the key individuals, one of the key founding members, a chap called Jock Lewis, who was not only the explosives expert in the unit, but also the training officer. And Stirling lost Lewis, and he was very close to Lewis, and it was a real body blow to him. He was killed on operations. And so Stirling turned around to Maine and said, "You will have to be training officer," because he reasoned he didn't have anyone else with the standing of a man like Maine to actually, you know, be able to inculcate the fighting spirit into the recruits during training. But of course, Maine had volunteered to fight the enemy. That's what he hungered to do. And that's what he'd said to Stirling when he agreed to join the SAS. He said, I'll come as long as there's every opportunity to fight. And so eventually, you know, they had their showdown, and they sealed their differences over a bottle of whiskey, as one used to do back then. and from then on, they were the yin and yang of the SAS. Though there was this fantastic combination who'd led these individuals repeatedly into battle and made them the bane of the Africa Corps and a massive contribution to turning the tide of the war in North Africa.
Fantastic. Thank you for that, Damien. Okay, I've got a little quote here from Karl Marx. And I don't often quote from Karl Marx, but the quote goes like this. Men make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under circumstances chosen by themselves, but under circumstances directly encountered. So I guess the Marxist perspective there of history would be that, yes, whilst they were instrumental, their circumstances and the structures and the context in which they found themselves also helped shape their history. So, in short, without these gentlemen, would the course of history have been the same in terms of the SAS and their operations in North Africa? So without them, if we'd have taken them out of the equation, the counterfactual history, would they still have been the SAS as effective in World War II, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, the SAS would not have existed were it not for Stirling and Maine and the original founders. Sure, you know, would if there had been an SAS and they had not been in it, would it have been so successful? I would argue not, no, because, you know, you'd have to go an extremely long way to find individuals like Stirling and Maine. I mean, you know, bear in mind, David Stirling, he was captured in January and February 1943, of course, on one of the most extraordinary missions of the SAS. David Stirling had already won a Distinguished Service Order, and he'd actually been put forward for a high valor, a French medal as well, a Croix de Guerre, but he never received it because he was in captivity. And then, of course, Maine went on to win 4 Distinguished Service Orders throughout the war, and he was actually citated for a Victoria Cross towards the end of the war, which makes him, the most highly decorated soldier of the British Army in the Second World War. These were not usual, normal individuals. These are extraordinary visionaries and warriors, and they had an extraordinary imagination and counterintuitive mindset. Can't stress that strongly enough. These were individuals who could think outside the box in ways that most of us would find impossible. And actually, that's why they were so unpopular with so many people in the British High Command. They in North Africa, they were branded as raiders of the thug variety. That will give you an indication of what
Yes.
many of those in high command thought of them. And there were repeated efforts made to disband them and do away with them. But, thank God they won through.
Absolutely. Thank you very much indeed. Okay, then. One of the perks, ladies and gentlemen, of doing podcasts is that you get sent through copies of books that you can browse through. And I've been having a good look through Damien's one. I haven't finished reading it yet, but I've been having a good look. Now, chapter 21 is entitled Gangster Style. And when I saw that and read it, it was somewhat more reminiscent, perhaps, of a Chicago-based Netflix series on the Italian-American mafia, perhaps, than maybe a 20th century unit of the British Armed Forces, which obviously still exists today. So, what aspect of the SAS story does gangster style cover and refer to? I just picked that one out because the chapter's title particularly stood out to me, Damien. Over to you.
Yeah, well, gangster style was that. It's a quote, actually. It's a quote from how they described that operation themselves. So what happened was, after dozens and dozens and dozens of raids, but being taken in by the Long Range Desert Group in their vehicles, but then going in to assault the targets on foot and leaving on foot, some of those air bases raided, several times over in the same way. But after dozens, scores of these such raids, of course, the enemy got wise to what was happening and they upped their defenses. So they had fences, strung around the air bases. They put sentries on the aircraft, sleeping underneath them in tents. They had guard dogs. They had mobile hunter patrols, which meant that if you continued to try and go onto those air bases on foot and carry out those raids, you were on a hiding to nothing. And so somebody, it's most likely Sterling, had the brainwave, another kind of leap of imagination and good faith, that they could try using the Willys Jeep, which was an American-made, really first 4x4, Jeep type vehicle ever made. And they had the idea that if they fitted them out with machine guns on pivots, maybe they could drive through the desert themselves, drive onto the air bases, smash their way through the perimeter, and hit with such speed and surprise that they could pull it off still. And that's where the idea gangster style came from. And that's exactly what they did. And it's amazing. They took these Vickers K machine guns, which were scavenged from old aircraft, because they were actually the Vickers K was developed as an aircraft, as a weapon to be used as a machine gun to be used on aircraft. Very, very quick rate of fire, but it was actually used on warplanes. So they took these machine guns from old, no longer operational warplanes, fitted them onto their Willys Jeeps on pivots. And they realized that with these, if they drove dozens of these jeeps onto the air bases and drove them straight down the runways with the aircraft lined up on either side, they could just hammer them with mixtures of tracer and armor-piercing rounds and then disappear just as quickly as they came. And that first raid, the raid on Fuka Aerodrome, which is absolutely, yeah, it's absolutely priceless. It's just, you could not make it up. They actually rehearsed for that raid with dozens of jeeps firing off their machine guns in the midst of the North African desert, hundreds of miles behind enemy lines. It's absolutely priceless. And they pulled off that raid. It's one of the most iconic of the whole Desert War. So that's where that title comes from, and that's where what the chapter tells. It's a remarkable story.
Wow, thank you very much indeed, Damien. Okay, then. We'll obviously wish you all the very, very best for your new book. The question is, what's Damien Lewis up to now and next? Now this one is published, now this one is out. What's next for Damien Lewis? And I guess it's going to involve more of you holding a quill, typing into a MacBook with your next publication, no doubt.
Yeah, so I actually have to write the sequel to this book because this covers the SAS up until early 1943, so the end of the North African campaign, and they're about to take the leap into southern Europe to Italy for the Sicily landings, which of course the SAS spearheaded. So that's the next book. Again, it's based upon the same trove of information and war memorabilia, priceless material, reports, diaries, letters, photographs, film that the Maine family have so generously made available. And it will tell the ongoing story and through to the latter stages of the war. And I'm really looking forward to writing it. It's picking up the same bunch of characters, those that, of course, were not killed or lost in the North Africa desert, taken prisoner. And it's something that I'm really excited about being able to write because, you know, these stories, we need to remember these stories in this day and age in particular when freedom all around the world is under siege. And we need to just remember freedom has to be fought for every day. And these guys sacrifice so much for the freedoms we have today.
Absolutely. Echo those sentiments 158%. Thank you very much, Damien. Okay, just before we let you go, then remind us of the title of the book, who it's published by, and then where we can get it, depending on where you are in the world, obviously.
Yeah, so it's called SAS Brothers in Arms. It's published by Quercus, and you can get it in all good bookshops and, of course, on Amazon. And it's in all the supermarkets. So please go out and have a peruse. It really is a story I'm very proud of having written. And, you know, it's actually echoing the story as told in the BBC series, which is out at the moment on the SAS. So that's another piece of real fabulous serendipity that I'm so proud of.
Thank you very much indeed. Absolutely delighted to have you on the podcast. Now, ladies and gentlemen, on social media, we'll be offering a few competitions. No questions this time, just likes and retweets, and we will send a copy or two out to the local, or whoever wins, wherever you are in the world. So keep your eye out for that. Damien, all the very, very best with the book. Just to let you know, Damien, on my way out to Bahrain, I saw one of your books at Heathrow Airport, and then now in Bahrain, there are copies of one of your publications for sale in the local WH Smith. So you really have gone global, my friend, and congratulations.
Thank you, Patrick. It's great to be on the show as
All right.
always.
Thank you so much. Hope to see you back soon, Damien. All the very,
Yeah,
very best, and we'll say goodbye.
absolutely. Cheers. Bye bye.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History Podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.